Welcome, movie fans. Thanks for joining us for episode 92 of Reading Between the Reels, the premier podcast of staring deeply into Ryan Gosling's eyes and trying to figure out what he's thinking. If you're a new listener, we're so glad you found us. And if you've been enjoying the show, please tell someone about us. Post on X or Facebook, write a review on your favorite podcast catcher, or just recommend the show to a friend. I am here today with myself, Justin Eldon, and Craig Dickinson. How you doing, Craig?
I'm doing well, Justin. I'm so excited to finally be talking about this movie with you.
Me too. Because the universe does not want me to talk about this movie, but here we are.
Yes.
All right, so today we are doing Blade Runner 2049, which is one of my all-time favorite movies, and I'm just so excited for it. Craig, initial thoughts. How do you feel about this movie?
I freaking love this movie. And I have to start with that I revisited this movie. I'd actually never seen this movie until Dune, the most recent Dune, Denis Villeneuve's Dune, came out. And then I was like, well, I really liked that. And I know that Denis Villeneuve did Blade Runner 2049. And I'd seen the original Blade Runner years before, but didn't really care for it. So I went back and revisited that movie. And then finally, it was like, I watched the final cut and was like, yes, I get it now. This is a great movie. I fully appreciate it. Well, give me more. And then watched this movie, 2049, and was like, okay, this is fantastic. I love this world. It's such an amazing visual experience watching this film. I mean, it won an award for best cinematography and best visual effects. Well deserved, in my opinion. It was nominated for some other ones as well, which we'll get to, but I just think it's beautiful. I think it's haunting. And like, even, you know, I said this when we did the original Blade Runner. It's so well done, it's hard to just pull out a handful of things to comment on. I could literally comment about the entire movie all the way through. There's so many good things.
I feel about this movie much of the same way I feel about Into the Spider-Verse movies. Like, it's beautiful start to finish. Like, you could screen grab any point of this film and be like, yes, that is a work of art. Like, it is so meticulously well done and just grand, and the color scheme and the set pieces and the world building, like so many parts of it. It makes me so sad that didn't do super well in the box office, at least probably not as well as they were hoping. So I'm guessing we're not going to get another sequel out of it, which just brings eternal sadness to my soul because I love Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. But this is one of those, I think, legacy sequels. We use that word a lot in this podcast, legacy sequels, that actually it enhances the first one for me. Not only does it build on it, but it makes the first one more enjoyable because it takes the world building a little bit further in a way that the first one felt confined, not necessarily in a bad way. Like, it was focused. But this one, it introduces you to new cities. It introduces you to new characters. It talks about events that happened off screen, like the blackout, that just lend itself to, oh, this is a real lived-in world.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It is, like you said, a work of art, and I can't wait to dive into composition, color, and camera work. I know you said that you wanted to talk more about just kind of overall what the movie's about. So,
oh yeah, so thank you for bringing me back there. So for those of you that it's been a while since you've seen the film and just need a refresher, Blade Runner 2049 is set 30 years after the original film. It follows the main character, who is a replicant, essentially an android designed to look and mimic humans as much as possible, which are mostly used for menial tasks or slave labor off-world, on a different world than Earth. And in this movie, like, the overarching plot is essentially there is this idea that replicants might be able to reproduce, which is relevant for a few things. One, it lends to the idea that maybe they are more than just androids. And two, the main, I guess, antagonist in there, whose name is, I got it, Wallace, played by Jared Leto. is particularly happy about that idea because it'd be much easier to create more of these androids for off-world work if they can reproduce. So the whole thing kind of centers around a mystery where Agent K, Ryan Gosling, is searching for like the truth in this. Is can replicants reproduce? And kind of he's being hunted for that, essentially.
Yes, that's great. That's a good synopsis. So I'm gonna just go ahead and jump in to composition, because this one, you know, it's, we mentioned Lego City sequel. It fits, it rhymes in so many ways, to borrow a phrase. In so many ways, like even the opening shot. First you have the opening script, which is in the same font as the original film, which catches us up what's been happening. There is hints, like you mentioned, about the blackout and what's happened during the 30 years. There's a lot of things that have been happening in the 30 years, and somehow we're kind of back to, you know, where we left off at the end of the last movie. And then you have this opening shot of an eye, whereas it was in the first movie, it was Roy Batty. I'm not sure who the eye is in this one. It's a green eye. Mm,
yeah.
I need to do a little bit more research on that, or maybe one of our listeners could come back with that. But it's like I said, there's just so many specific things, but I'll just pull some just general categories that there's, first off, just so many wide establishing shots. Again, just showing off the world that we live in here. You've got, in the sense of scale in this film too, there's so many immense, just enormous things, like the statues in Vegas, just ridiculously sized, the giant Joy holograms, just fantastic sense of scale, which is always a thing that is interesting to me.
That right there is, I think, okay, so when I first watched this, I didn't know Craig. Did I? Let me think. Did I know you? I don't think I knew you super well at that time.
I don't think so.
And I didn't get super into it. I just kind of watched it. I'm like, oh, that was a great movie. And then the second time I watched it was right after Craig had watched it. I'd met Craig and he'd watched it. And that's what you had mentioned. You mentioned the scale, and you mentioned how it was the same director as Dune and Arrival, which both have like huge, like the scale again, mm-hmm. is just out of this world. And the more times I watch this film, I've probably seen it 4 or 5 times now, the more I appreciate that scale. Like it lends itself well to, this is a world. This is it's different than your world. It's Earth, but it's different. It's kind of diverted from a different timeline, and things are going to look a little bit different, yet somehow familiar at the same time. I love that you brought up like Vegas. I think Vegas is, the color scheme is such a departure from anything else in the movie. You got like a lot of oranges and browns. Whereas the other cities are kind of dark and run down and bluish neon lights and things like that. It's so hauntingly beautiful. I don't know, maybe. Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah. Great.
Yeah. And you know, the colors are really extreme. I noticed that right off the bat, like the deep shadows in this film, it's some very dark, deep shadows, especially like starting in Sapper's house, which is then contrasted pretty quickly. You mentioned the gray and stuff. That you have this yellow flower over Rachel's grave, that you have this life found where it's entirely unexpected, and it just stands out remarkably there. But there's also like kind of golden hour lighting inside the Wallace Corporation, which I thought was really interesting. It's like perpetually almost like twilight time they're in there.
Well, and I thought about that inside the Wallace building. It was interesting. The lighting was always moving. And mm-hmm. it was always moving differently, no matter what room he went into. It's almost like shades were constantly opening or constantly closing. It was unsettling. It made you feel off balance quite a bit. And yeah. I think the same goes for everything about Wallace. The guy is just unsettling. Jared Leto plays that really well. He's an unsettling feller.
Well, it's got, you know, it has the appearance of waves, almost like water. And there we do see like a giant pool at one point inside the Wallace Corporation. And of course, water is always associated with birth too. So it makes sense that you've kind of, it's subconsciously talking to you about the womb and origin of life and that stuff. And then this is where the, you know, the replicants are. Really interesting subconscious way to do that. I did have a few other things that I really liked. Some specific shots. I think the one in particular is the shot of the boiling water during Kay's interrogation of Sapper, that it's getting closer and closer to boiling over as the tension is building, because we don't quite know what's going to happen. Just because it just cuts away just to show that, which I think is genius. Then you have the slow like zoom, continually zooming in on the serial number, which you see on the bones, where it's like, oh, this is a womb. And then it's like, no, hold on. Keep zooming in. And all of a sudden you get this reveal that this is an artificial person that had a cesarean section. So
I did think that scene was a little bit funny, how Kay, Ryan Gosling, tells him to stop. He's like, zoom in, zoom in, zoom in. Like, how did you see that? I mean, I know he's a replicant and he has, I mean, it shows later that they have like cognitive abilities that are a little bit faster than humans, but like, how could you possibly have seen that? Anyway, but that was a fantastic scene.
And the only other one I wanted to bring up was when Kay makes it to the orphanage and he's digging for the hidden horse, there's just this close up on his hands. And you don't even see him at all while he's doing the dig. And then after that, there's this close up on his face. But you never see the whole thing at once. Mm-hmm. And then it flashes to just the number on the bottom. And then there's the horse back at the apartment. It's just all these kind of very separate things. I thought was really, because there's this disconnect for him, right? And then like, it's also, you know, like on the one hand, you can kind of see from his perspective that it's kind of shocking and there's this disconnect. He's trying to, you know, reconcile this, but it's also a disconnect because it's, spoiler, it's not actually his horse.
So you mentioned close up on Kay's face. I think I want to say like a good 20% of this movie is just close ups of Kay's face, like almost emotionless. Like there's really not a whole lot going on, but somehow, and I rewatched a couple scenes and tried to figure out how. Is it the music? Is it the lighting? What is it? Somehow, without making any facial expressions, except for like he looks like he's like holding in a scream so often, but with the exception of that, he doesn't do a whole lot to tell the audience what he's thinking, yet somehow you always know what he's thinking. And I cannot figure out why. It's so well done, and it makes me respect Ryan Gosling as an actor so much more, because he says so much without doing or saying anything. I don't get it, but it's fantastic.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I think we might have talked about it on a previous show. There's a Nerdwriter video on YouTube that talks about how Ian McKellen uses his eyes when he acts, specifically in the Lord of the Rings movies. And I was reminded of that here, that it's with his eyes that he's telling you. He has these deep, soulful eyes, and like there's a lot going on there. That he's not, you know, it's surprising, because like, he does have kind of the one breakdown where he thinks he's discovered that he's Rachel's kid, right? He flips out. But other than that, it's all pretty restrained.
So when you first saw this movie, we're going to get off track a little bit.
No, that's fine.
How did you feel about like the red herring where he wasn't Rachel's kid? Like the movie led you to believe that. Mm-hmm. Did you believe it when the movie led you down that way?
No, I absolutely did. And, along with that, I also thought it was brilliant that, and I'm sure we'll talk about this multiple points, that the original Blade Runner has the question of whether or not Deckard is a replicant. And that, first off, this movie does not answer that.
Love that so much. He is a replicant.
But I love the choice. I thought it was really cool that at the beginning we meet essentially the Deckard stand-in. That's Kay's fulfilling that Deckard role in this. And they just straight up, no, he's a replicant. They just straight up tell you. Like, we're not going to play that game in this one. And so I was already on board for that. And then I thought it was a brilliant red herring. I thought, yes, you're leading us down this road. I'm absolutely on board for that. I would absolutely be okay if it was. I'm okay with the other one, the other way it goes too. But yeah, I bought it.
I thought it was such a good subversion of expectation. Because you watch a movie and you assume that the main character is the main character in the world as well. And then it turns out, oh no, he's just a replicant. He's just a regular old replicant. Regular Joe, you might say.
Oh. Yeah, his job is to get Deckard and his daughter together.
Yeah, I really, really like that. And it was funny, the second time I watched this movie, I had forgotten that he wasn't that. So I got surprised twice. It's great.
It's that well made, man.
It is. And you can sense his frustration too. And I like when he comes to that realization, not when he comes to the realization, he is told that he is not the child, and he's a little disappointed by it. And I think probably a lot of audience members are a little disappointed too, but, it almost makes it more fun if there was a third one. It would make it a little bit more fun knowing that he would just kind of be in a replicant army, or like a replicant resistance, not necessarily leading the charge, which would be fun to see as well. And I do like the role reversal quite a bit too from the first one, because the first one you're seeing everything through what we assume to be a human's eyes, whereas this one everything is through a replicant's eyes, and you get to kind of see the race. Is it racism if it's different species?
I mean, speciesism. It's prejudice.
Yeah, I don't know. You get to see, I guess, the bigotry from his end, and just like how much he has to ignore in order to exist in the world. Like, he just walks into his apartment when there's all that hate speech written on it.
Yeah, even at his job too, like skin job and all these little things.
Yeah, at his job where he's legitimately helping these people. They treat him like trash. And it lends itself really well to the world building again. You can see this like clear class divide between humans and replicants, even though replicants are superior in just about every single way.
True. Well, I was going to say too, you also have Joy. She basically straight up tells him, yeah, you are. She confirms, so to speak, that he is, you know, that he is Rachel's kid. And you don't know if that's a projection of, I mean, this is, and you get into how much of this is actual artificial intelligence, how much is a reflection of the way he's essentially programmed her by the fact that she's existed with him for so long. But she tells us, as the audience too, like, yes, your suspicions are confirmed. You are, you're born, not made.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love Joy in that film too. Sorry, we're going to get off more into the weeds.
Yeah.
Because you have the class divide again of humans and replicants, and then you can divide it even further to another subsection of humans, replicants, and then holograms, which are considered less than replicants because they're purely artificial intelligence, but Kay doesn't necessarily treat her that way. Kay treats her as if she were real. And it kind of lends itself to the question again of, okay, what is real? How far do we need to go down this rabbit hole before things are assigned like original thought, which we kind of see in today's society quite a bit too with AI emerging. Mm-hmm. At what point is it true artificial intelligence? I don't know.
Well, and I was going to say something earlier, but I'll say it now too, that this, I mean, this is 2017, and the effects for Joy, the hologram, is spectacular and better than I've seen. It is some of the best CGI I've ever seen. The way that they blend that, it's seamless. So, I mean, even the pretty eerie, but strangely beautiful thing too, where she kind of merges with the other, with Mariette too. It's like such a complicated shot, a series of shots, really. But I think they pull that off beautifully. It's creepy, like as the way it kind of should be, but it's also kind of beautiful in the same way.
Yeah, and it characterizes Kay quite a bit as well. Just it lends to how human-like he is. I mean, he needs that like physical connection as well as the emotional one. So much so that he's willing to put himself in that really weird situation. First time I saw that scene, I'm like, what is happening
here? Yeah, that's science fiction, baby.
Yeah.
Anything else in visuals before we move on to the stuff we hear, the sound?
No, I think we're good. We can move on.
So, should mention right off the bat, this was Oscar nominated for best sound editing and best sound mixing. Lost both to Dunkirk, which I'm okay with because I love Dunkirk. I love Nolan.
I'm going to say that's cheating.
It's right there. I know.
It's cheating because Dunkirk is using real sounds from like, these are things that actually exist. Sure. Whereas Blade Runner, all of those sound, not all of them, most of those sounds are imagined.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's got to be so much harder. Like, what does a flying car sound like?
Yeah.
What does a city sound like in the year 2049? What is a radiation ridden Las Vegas sound like? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had right off the bat the spinners, the whirring sound. Like, it's such a great sound. I love it so much.
Wait, what is it?
the spinners, like just the kind of that whirring sound they make as they take off and land, and really kind of just general. Yeah, they're, you know, the flying cars, the spinners.
Are they called spinners?
Yeah, they're called spinners. They've always been called spinners. Yeah.
Okay.
So I had that, and I had the Wallace Corporation jingle chimes, which
is
kind of happy, but also kind of creepy. But one thing that I really liked was when Love kills Joshi? I can't remember her name. The boss, Robin Wright's character. They show it from outside the window, and there's no sound, which I thought was fascinating because this is how I interpret it, that we're as detached from that as Love is. Love is just, she's not, doesn't care. Like, there's no, I'm taking a human life. It's just like, I'm just, you know, this is something in my way and I'm taking care of it.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was a brilliant choice just to take us right outside the window and show us the whole thing, but we don't need to hear it.
I'm going to get us off task here, but here we are.
It's all on task.
What is your thoughts on the replicant Love, just in general? Like, I almost feel like I think she's in there to be a mirror to Kay,
mm-hmm.
right? But it almost seems like she struggles with a lot of her job. Like, she is not very happy about what she's doing. So what is her motivation? What is she doing there?
I mean, I think ultimately she's trying to, in some ways, earn Wallace's respect, love, maybe, like as a father. But I think there's also more other relations happening there as well.
You think so?
It's kind of the way I read it. I think that she's trying to get his approval, though, more than anything. And I think that she doesn't think that she's quite reaching those levels. But I think that's kind of explains the obsessive nature of her actions, that she's ultimately just trying to please him.
The actress that plays her does not look like, she looks quite a bit different in real life.
Yeah, she's pretty extreme with the makeup and stuff in this. She says something about, like, I'm his favorite, or he likes me best, or something at one point.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where I'm pulling from that too. But yeah, as a foil for Kay, I think that's a good
foil. There we go. That's the word, not mirror.
Well, yeah. Those are both the same thing. Yeah, you're good.
So that particular scene, I was going to mention that one too, about Robin Wright's character getting killed, but also the neon throughout the movie, you know, tons of neon, especially that particular roof scene where Kay and Joy head to the roof when she first has the ability to, like, be mobile.
Mm-hmm.
The buzz of the neon is such a familiar, I think, sound to a lot of people, and it's almost like an irritating sound. And as it's in almost every scene within the city. And it just adds, like, this layer of background noise that is so unsettling, and sometimes is almost overpowering in the way it's portrayed. And it just makes the world feel heavy, you know, like no one on that world is happy. And I think the first one portrays that quite a bit more, just the extreme, I don't know, degradation of the cities and how everyone is just living, and that's about it. And I think the first one in the book kind of go into this quite a bit more than the second one. The second world one did not talk about off-world quite as much. Mm-hmm. And about how, like, Earth is pretty much doomed. Like, everyone is kind of, you know, forget you, Earth. The goal is to move off-world. And the neon just makes you do that because it's visually and audibly frustrating, and it just makes you feel gross, just that constant hum of everything. And just noise in general. It's just a noisy environment. Everything is always in your face. All those ads are always in your face. Particularly that scene where, oh man, poor Ryan Reynolds. He had, like, the crappiest day of his life. His face is all beat up and he's walking home and the giant hologram of Joy just comes down and so impersonably, like, addresses him, and he's like, he loved Joy, and then this giant Joy advertisement just, like, pops up. And
after Joy's essentially died, right?
Yeah. She just got smushed. Oh, that poor guy.
Yeah.
And again, you have that scene where it's supposed to be appealing to him personally. Like, it has some form of, like, tracking because it addresses him by name. But at the same time, it's just so impersonal. And then you still have like the hum of the neon during that scene. Poor K. Poor guy.
Okay. Hans Zimmer did the score. I love Hans Zimmer. And Walfish as well. So there's a little bit of The Dark Knight I heard in this, a little bit. But absolutely it builds on Vangelis' work, the guy that did the first movie. Lots of deep tones and synthesizer. There's kind of an ominous drum beat as K enters Vegas, which I thought was pretty cool. And of course it uses, and we talked about, you know, the death scene at the end. This it uses Tears in the Rain as as K lies down, which is what a great callback to that. One of the central themes of that first movie, and also in this one, you know, about what it means to be human, and he's kind of reached his purpose. You know, he's fulfilled his purpose at this point, but is just as human as it, even though he's not the, you know, not the born, he's not a, not born, he was, it was actually made, that he's just as real as she is.
So is K right? Dead? You mentioned him lying down at the end of the Tears in the Rain.
I think he's dead. I think he's dead. And I say, this is what I would say, because it's Tears in the Rain. And that's when Batty died. That I think that's what we're supposed to take from that. That's how I take it.
That would make me sad because I love him as a character. His whole just his whole aesthetic, everything about him is just fantastic. But I don't think I was convinced he was dead until you mentioned that it was Tears in the Rain, and I don't pick up on that stuff like you do. But I think that might suggest he's a goner.
I mean, it doesn't have to be, but it's clearly a scene that echoes the earlier scene from the first movie. But that's my translation there, or my conclusion.
So what do you think about it being a legacy sequel? It wouldn't be a legacy sequel unless you had some of the original actors in there. The incorporation of Harrison Ford. Too much? Too little? Just right?
Let's go ahead and slide down to performances we're doing. I think it's the exact right amount. And it's, I looked it up. How late is it when he shows up? It's fairly late in the film. Right?
Yeah, it's like 2/3 of the way through the film.
Oh yeah, an hour and 45 minutes in. So there's like an hour left of the film, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's perfect because I think he's super important from the beginning. I mean, it's because you have Rachel that shows up at the beginning. Obviously, that makes you think of Deckard. And then you even have a little bit, kind of go back to sound for just a second. You have his voiceover, a little bit of the Voight Kampff test, right, with him and Rachel. He's kind of lingering in the background and you're anticipating him. Just kind of this, he's kind of the shadowy figure. You know, he's the key to some of this. But it's not really his film. And I was totally fine with it. I think he was in it the exact right amount.
Yeah. I have an issue when they do these legacy sequels and they bring in these old actors who are obviously, you know, they're old. They're not in the same physical shape that they were. And you can tell they struggle with some of the physical scenes, and you can see the stunt doubles in there when they, you know, land a punch or there's an explosion or something like that. And I'm very glad that he was not introduced until the end. I love Harrison Ford. I love Deckard, but it was not his movie. He was a side character, and I thought that was perfect. And his introduction to where he is. He's in Vegas. He's like, everyone leave me alone. I have like a mountain of alcohol that I've drank over the last, you know, 20, 30 years. He's just living it up in like giant Vegas casinos. I thought that was so on brand for him because he's such like an antisocial character. And they did that perfectly. And even better, they never answered the question, is he a replicant? Which he is, obviously, but in my opinion. But I was really worried going into this that they were going to definitively answer that question and kind of ruin it. But they did not.
Yeah. I mean, hint of that where Jared Leto at one point says something like that's why you were designed that way to kind of fit with Rachel, or whatever. It's like, or you weren't. Or something. Yeah. You know, there's. I remember watching the first time through going, holy smokes, they full on went there. They're just going to straight up tell us it was. And, you know, 30 years of speculation out the window, and now it's definitive. Nope, it's not. And I was like, oh, that's brilliant. It's painful and brilliant at the same time.
at that point, you know, they're just messing with the fans.
Yeah. It's a little fan baiting there, but in a good way.
Yeah.
So yeah, straight up performance is great all around. I'll agree with that. Some of them, I mean, Gosling is fantastic in this. I thought Ana de Armas too, like as Joy, she plays multiple versions of Joy. And I think it's maybe her best performance that I've ever seen. She's quite good.
I think so. I think this is the first movie I saw her in.
Yeah.
And then after this, I watched a couple more movies with her in it. And I think I was disappointed every other movie I saw her in, because not that she's bad ever, but this is by far her best. I don't think anyone, like usually in movies, I have an issue where, oh, this particular character, I think he was miscast or doesn't quite fit the role. Everyone in here is so good. So good. Like even kind of the smaller roles, like the file clerk at Wallace Corporation.
Yeah.
That like creepy, like bald guy. Like he does super well.
The baby pictures thing. Yeah. All that.
Oh yeah. Well, that's a shame. You must've been adorable, or I forget what he says, but that's great. Yeah. Everyone just fits the aesthetic of this world super well. They got the actor that plays Gaff back, the guy that does all the origami.
Edward James Olmos. Yeah.
Yeah. That was impressive. And he added a fun little element to it too. Was he in Old Folks Home? Is that what that was?
I think that's what that was.
Yeah.
I was going to say Dave Bautista plays a really restrained, very different character than we've seen. Like he's very anti-Drax. Like he's super intelligent, well-spoken, but also he obviously can handle himself physically. So.
Yeah. The casting directors, I could go through 100 people and I don't think I would ever think, yeah, Dave Bautista should definitely play Sapper, but it works. It works so freaking well. And it almost seems like a waste, because it's such like a small role and you have this like jacked guy that if you were to say, okay, Ryan Gosling versus Dave Bautista, that's not going to go well.
Well, it's a little... Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just saying it's a little reminiscent of like Terminator 2, where you have Robert Patrick fighting Schwarzenegger, where it's like it works because they're both not human. Right. And so it's surprising, but it also works, and it's visually interesting to see that
happen. Yeah. And that's the beginning scene with Dave Bautista and Ryan Gosling. That's where we really it straight up tells us that he's a replicant, which he better be, because Dave Bautista like throws him through a wall.
Yeah.
And at that point you're like, okay, something's different here. He's got some abilities.
So lines of dialogue. Did you have one or two lines from this movie? I had a ton. You really want to
pull up? Okay, let me pull that up. You go first.
Okay. thanks. Okay, I'm just going to pull out a couple of Neander Wallace. That's Jared Leto. He actually had some very interesting things to say. But one he says is that pain reminds you the joy you felt was real. He's talking to Deckard about Rachel there.
Not wrong.
No.
Do you think this is Jared Leto's best performance?
I mean, he's really, really good in this. And even kind of restrained. I mean, he can kind of just go off the rails a little bit sometimes. And I haven't seen everything that he's been in.
Yeah.
But I think they got Jared Leto. I mean, no, at one point I think it was David Bowie was someone they were interested in casting for this.
Oh, I could have seen. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, and I think they probably hired Leto because he's got this reputation for being very odd. And
no.
And okay. Wallace is very odd, and I think a little bit of casting to type, but I think he's perfect for it.
The cadence to his the way he speaks is amazing. I don't know how he comes up with that, but it's off-putting. It's like the Wallace Corporation, where you feel uncomfortable being there, and the way he speaks, it's almost unpredictable. Where the voice inflections, it's very strange. Mm-hmm. All right. So one of my favorite lines: Harrison Ford just has such great delivery because he's an old curmudgeon. But when Kay meets his dog and he asks, "Is it real?" and he just goes, "I don't know. Ask him." which is awesome for Deckard's character, because it shows the character growth. Like, he used to be a Blade Runner that hunted replicants, and now he doesn't care. He's just like,
no,
it's alive. Like, it doesn't matter if it's real or not. like he's shown growth there through his like decade long love for Rachel. I don't know. Ask him. Harrison.
Yes. So I will throw out another Wallace quote. This one says, "All the courage in the world cannot alter fact."
That seems like a Craig Dickinson quote.
That's a good quote, man. He's like switching things.
Yeah. If any of you know Craig Dickinson personally, I feel like that's something that he would say.
Tell your students that.
That is a good one. I don't know if anything else like super stood out to me. I mean, a lot of it's really good. I feel bad like pulling out the Wallace quotes as deep as insightful because he's kind of a psychopath.
Well, I mean, here's another one that's a psychopathic one, where he says, "Every leap of civilization was built off the back of a disposable workforce. We lost our stomach for slaves unless engineered, but I can only make so many." Yeah, it's like, yeah, I'm okay with slavery. Like, it's, you know, we need that.
Someone's gonna clip that.
Yeah,
someone's gonna clip that, Craig, and you're gonna be canceled so quick,
out of context. Yeah, that's what he's okay with slavery. Like, it's just a different flavor of slavery. They're like looking at them as less than humans. And like you alluded to earlier, like he wants to find a way for replicants to procreate, not for their sake, but so that he can own them too.
Yeah. Yeah. And the way he's, again, going back to his cadence, like the way he says that is so great. Same with, I'm looking up lines on IMDb, just straight up, to be honest. He says that line, "You do not know what pain is yet. You will learn," which isn't that cool of a line, but the way he says it,
yeah,
is a learn. Cool line.
Yeah.
You will learn.
You will learn. Yeah. There. Yeah. That's so good. I'm going to slide down a little bit to body language. We talked a lot about Kay's eyes. I had that earlier. You mentioned joy outside in the rain, just the way that she's just expressing wonder just with her body language and her face, not really saying a whole lot.
I love that scene when they're in the rain on the rooftop, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's almost like, so Kay is so happy to have her outside of the home, like it makes her feel more real.
Yeah.
But you can almost see the disappointment every single time she glitches out and like the rain falls through her again.
Yeah.
Because he's constantly reminded, oh, not real. Oh, not real. Rain's falling through.
I think the last thing I had with that, just we talked about love before. The first time that she meets Kay, she's sitting down and she has her hands. Well, actually, no, she's walking around. She has her hands folded neatly in front of her. But I look at that like she almost feels like she's a coiled snake. Like she's reserved, but it's like it's just this tension. Mm-hmm. She's about to snap, and we see her very violent. I'll do that a little later on.
A little bit, again, looking to these movie quotes, a part I really enjoyed with love was when they're walking around Wallace Corporation, and which again is this great world building. She takes that little ball orby thing that we assume like holds some sort of data, and she sticks it in the little computer, and it like reads the glass ball, which I just, little touch, little bit of world building. Some guy making props probably spent several hours on that, but it was cool and it added to the film. But while they're talking, she says the line, "It is invigorating being asked personal question, makes one feel desired." And then I noticed right after that, she asks him a personal question.
Yep.
As if she is like, "Hey, you're a replicant. I'm a replicant." But again, is that just like, is she manipulating him? Is she genuinely attracted to him? Like, what is she doing there? She's so creepy on so many levels. You never know quite what's going on with her.
You know, that's a good catch. I saw there was a thing earlier too when Kay brings the horse back to his apartment, and then Robin Wright's character's in there, where she, and I didn't catch this the first couple of times, but she's legitimately hitting on him. He's an attractive man, and he's very popular with the ladies. And then
Joy even like references it later.
I think that's how I caught it.
Ashamed.
Like, oh wow, look at that. I really like, as far as costumes go, I really like Kay's coat. I think that's it's really cool. I'd love to have one like that. That high collar and stuff. It's pretty cool. Sapper's wireframe glasses.
Like a Russian conscript coat.
Yeah. The glasses that he puts on really meticulously, Dave Bautista puts on, I think kind of helps sell this highly intelligent character that he plays. And then just all the outfits and hairstyles that Joy has. It's flashing at the beginning, first time we meet her. It's like 1950s housewife and all the way through modern stuff. So
I was really happy with just Kay's whole look in general, because Deckard was really iconic. I don't know, maybe it's the generation I grew up in, but as a kid, I always wanted a trench coat. Mm-hmm. I feel like if I could just have a trench coat, I would be cool. And the first time I saw this movie, I'm like, Deckard has a trench coat. He's automatically cool. Well, and then Kay kind of does like the newer version of that with the kind of like the, I don't know, the faux, what is that stuff called around like his neck? Fur? Yeah, like it's probably not real fur because
everything's
animals
fake.
Basically don't exist in this world. But yeah, he looks so cool.
Yeah, dude, trench coats. You got Deckard. You got Highlander. You got Neo. I mean,
trench coats are cool.
Trench coats are cool.
Yeah, I just don't think I could probably pull that off.
I had one many years ago.
I don't know. Of course you did.
Of course I did. Let's see. Setting and design of Oscar nomination for best production design, but lost to The Shape of Water.
What? No.
Don't I disagree. Hard disagree there. Yeah. Especially considering that most of this took place on a soundstage in Budapest. Or Budapest? Did you say that?
I don't know. I've heard it both ways.
Yeah. You and I remember Budapest very differently. Los Angeles. The original was filmed in Los Angeles in certain places. This was not. But it does feel, we mentioned it feels enormous. Most of that is CGI. I do love, though, you mentioned this a little bit. I do love that you see Atari and Pan Am ads, especially the Atari one, huge from like bird's eye view. Because you mentioned, like, this is not an extension of our world. It's an extension of the Blade Runner 2019 world.
Yep.
So it's kind of which I remember hearing about that when some of the behind the scenes stuff was like, okay, yeah, no, I see why that would be important. Because they're kind of predicting that these things would have been big. And then, you know, I think in the Blade Runner episode we did, we talked about how tons of these things, like Atari, like, had massive stock losses, like, immediately after Blade Runner came out.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah, there's like a curse or something. Yeah, if you bunch of different corporations took it in the shorts shortly after appearing in Blade Runner.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
So I wonder, was the original Blade Runner with Harrison Ford was that meant to be in a different world, in a different timeline?
See, I don't think so. I think, yeah. I mean, you're looking at it's 1982 and Atari is big at that time. You're thinking, why would Atari go out of business? I mean, imagine if, you know, 30 years from now, Apple doesn't exist as a company. I mean, it'd be kind of like that, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking to see what I have for set decoration and props. I did kind of mention the watery look in the Wallace Corporation. We've kind of talked about a lot of stuff. Kay's shower, man, that thing is, and really all of his apartment is very utilitarian.
Yes.
Very fast, very just Spartan in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Gets the job done and nothing further. Can we talk about Kay's gun and by extension, Deckard's gun?
Please.
I love those props. They are so iconic. You don't get to see Kay's gun quite as much as you saw Deckard's gun in the first one. Because in the first one, you see it quite a bit when he's fighting Roy Batty. But it is so grounded and sci-fi at the same time. And it just, oh, I love it. It looks so cool. I even think there's the guy that does Mythbusters. What's his name? I don't know. One of the
Adam something,
guys.
Right?
Adam Savage, maybe? I think he like created a replica and he has like a whole episode about the replica of Deckard's gun. And I just, it's so, so good looking.
Yeah, it's cool.
And iconic in a way that I think like Star Wars has very iconic weapons, like, Luke Skywalker's blaster and Han Solo's blaster. And then we get the same thing here. It's just top notch. You can pick it out of a lineup. It looks, I hate to use this word again, but like utilitarian.
Mm-hmm.
And just like it could, that could actually exist. It's not too crazy or out there, and it looks beat up and it looks lived in and used. It's so cool looking.
That's very much the Blade Runner aesthetic though, right? Like everything is nothing is extra, right? It needs to feel like there's a purpose to all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of par for the course. I had a question for you. The wooden horse, is it my imagination or did I read this somewhere? Or is it like it used to be a unicorn and the horn broke off? Is that just me?
I have never heard that. Okay. But
because I'm thinking, you know, unicorn from Blade Runner and whatnot. I think that would have been.
Oh.
Thought that maybe was a thing.
But that wouldn't.
You know, there's a fan theory if Corey were here.
Corey. Where's he at?
He should be back.
What's the fan theory? Let's hear it.
No, that's it. Just that it would be a connection. It would be kind of, you know, nice rhyming thing. Rather than it just being a horse, it'd be a unicorn.
Okay, well, let's think about the unicorn in the first one, though. Mm-hmm. The unicorn in the first one represents the idea that Deckard might be a replicant, right?
Yeah, but only in the sense because Gaff makes the origami unicorn, and it's like he would have access to his memories because his memories aren't real, I guess, is the extension of that.
Okay, so if that's the case with that unicorn, why would this horse be a unicorn? Because that horse came from the memory of Deckard's daughter, who is... Yep. Oh, would she be a replicant? I guess she would be a replicant. Well, she's a replicant?
She's at least half replicant.
At least half replicant.
Unless he's a replicant. Yeah. Dr. Anna Staline, which we haven't said her name yet.
Hmm.
I do want to point out, I don't know, I'd love to hear what some of our listeners think. Wallace's drone eyes. I wanted to mention that. Just the fact that he's completely dependent upon technology, which kind of makes sense that he's continually producing that.
Oh, go ahead.
Relationship. I was just going to say he has a very important relationship with technology. He needs it.
And I thought it was interesting that he has the ability to see with technology, like there, or in some capacity, maybe not in the same way humans do, but there's a time where like little drones come in and it seems like he has more of an awareness of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And he puts like a little dot thing. Is it on his temple or on his neck? I don't remember.
I think it's on his neck.
So he has the ability to see in some capacity with technology, but he opts out of using it all the time, which was interesting. What's your why might he do that, do you think? Thoughts?
I don't know.
Why not just see all the time? I don't know.
Doesn't look as cool.
I'm trying to Google images of this wooden horse to see if there's like a broken off horn on it, and I can't really get a good one.
While we're doing that, what did you think of the memory maker, the camera lens looking thing? Because I have no idea how that thing's supposed to work. That looked really complicated.
I thought it was awesome. It was reminiscent of like almost like an old Nikon camera or something. And she was kind of holding it and using it as one. But it looked like a very specialized tool, which I thought was awesome. But yeah, I have no freaking idea how that thing would have worked. I do like that they kind of showed us how those memories are created.
Yeah, I love those scenes.
And it's just so tragic. You feel so sad for that girl. I don't know. What else is that girl in that plays... the memory maker, because she did a great job.
Yeah, let me see here, because we're getting down to cast. Carla Jury or Yuri? Sylvia Hooks, though, is the one who plays Love. I won't say that. She's from Switzerland. Yuri. She has been in Wetlands, Finster World, and Blade Runner 2049. So not a whole lot.
All right. Don't know her.
But yeah, she has obviously has a very strong resemblance to Sean Young.
Who?
Rachel.
Oh.
You know, the one that plays her mom. Which I will have to say that when Sean Young-ish shows up, that
ish.
Yes, you know what I mean. Because it's a body double, and then you've got like they did kind of like Leia in Rogue One with the face. That it absolutely is Uncanny Valley, but it works because it is, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Because Deckard is not fooled by that.
It feels soulless. Disturbed. And
yes.
It's like one of the only replicants that do feel soulless.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, she was made for the sole purpose of manipulating Deckard.
Yeah.
Which I love Deckard's line where he tells Wallace that the eyes are wrong.
Yeah.
So they're right. Not. They're absolutely not. Like, he has the right color eyes. Deckard's just like straight up lying to him.
Did he say he said they were green? Is that what he said?
And I don't think they're green.
I'm pretty sure
they're like that dark, dark brown.
She has very dark brown eyes. I mean, I haven't seen her in all of her movies, but I'm thinking Ace Ventura, she has brown eyes.
I'm looking at images of her right now. She's got brown eyes, except for when they're the replicant eyes, where they're, you know, the shimmery gold.
Yeah.
Do we get any replicant eyes in this movie? Maybe that's something they fixed.
See, I think Jared Leto's eyes from certain angles, I think, is the most reminiscent of that.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, I mean, assuming those are like receptors for the drones, and so those would be artificial. But no, we don't get the typical things like we did a lot in the first movie, like with the owl, and of course with Rachel and her scene with the Voight Kampf and whatnot. David DeSmalchin as Coco. What a weird name.
Oh, that guy. When I said like this was cast perfectly,
yeah,
because you have these like kind of creepy actors. He's a creepy actor. He's in Suicide Squad as
Polka Dot Man
for those of you listening. And he's like an interesting looking fellow.
Yeah.
And he's got a kind of a weird vibe to him. Yeah. But he does pretty well in this one.
Hyder DeVries in Dune, of course. Looks like Tomas Lemarkey, I might be saying this name totally wrong, is the guy who plays the clerk.
The file clerk, yeah. Very creepy. Great job.
And I think, Wood Harris shows up, which is kind of weird. I know him mainly from like the Creed movies. He's as Nandez. He shows up just briefly in a scene at the police headquarters, and I was like, "What's that dude doing here?" Not very much. Like a walk-on part. That's about it.
Yep. Maybe he was just in town that day, and they're like, "Hey, buddy."
I mean, I like his acting, but it was just kind of took me out of the film for a second. I'm like, "What movie am I watching?" Anything else for performance or characters?
I feel like this is the part of the podcast where I normally just like rail on somebody for sucking. I think last time in Sherlock Holmes, it was freaking Beth. What's her name?
Oh, again?
The walking corpse. What's her name?
Yeah, I can't think now. Oh, you're killing me.
Beth from Yellowstone? Kelly, oh, man. She's
Kelly,
the worst.
Kelly Riley.
We don't have any Beths in this
she's
movie.
She's a beautiful woman, and she should come on our show and just to taunt you.
I would turn my camera off. I wouldn't even want to look at her face.
No, we're going to be the Yellowstone podcast just because of that. We're going to change things up.
Just kidding. I would love to generate new insults for her every single day.
Wow.
That being said, I'm sure she's a lovely person, personality wise.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. I would say moving down to Hero's Journey that no, it's not really. But I do like the fact that you essentially had Kay kind of as the stand-in for Deckard. But they kind of diverge in several important ways. Where it's, again, the overall question is just continue, like, what does it mean to be human? Like, that's the way I take this away. And I love that you pointed out the thing about that there is not just humans and replicants, but there's also the thing with, like, Joy and the holograms that she's, at least as far as I can tell, she's clearly sentient, but she's also even a lower class life form.
What makes you think that she's sentient? Because that was the question I had throughout this.
Oh, yeah. See, now...
In the same way in the first Blade Runner, you're asking, are the replicants sentient? And now this time you're like, replicants are sentient. Okay, now are holograms sentient?
Well, she's either sentient or she's been programmed so very well that she... Well, because she seems to anticipate Kay's every need and desire and want and preferences.
So is that sentience or is that like a really, really good algorithm?
I mean, she even... the fact that she initiates the contact with Marriott, played by Mackenzie Davis, who we should mention, that's outside of what Kay would want necessarily, or definitely what he planned. Like, he did not intend for that to happen. So I think that fact that she took initiative to do that, I think is evidence of her sentience. But then, of course, now you got me going down the rabbit hole now, because she's a spy for the resistance. In fact, that she gets in there is the reason they're able to check Kay. In fact, all the way into Vegas and all of that stuff. So,
okay, so if we take this to like the most basis level, you go on YouTube, you sign into your YouTube account, and it recommends a bunch of videos based off your preferences and based off, you know, it's the algorithm.
Yep.
And it puts you in your own little echo chamber. Okay, so take that one step further. It seems to anticipate your wants and anticipate your needs. Mm-hmm. If I were to log into Craig Dickinson's YouTube account, it would recommend very different stuff than what I'm seeing.
True.
So is joy just that times 10? It's recommending to Kay what Kay wants to see, what Kay wants to hear. And then by that, are replicants just a result? Like, is their personality a result of algorithms that over time create what seems to be a personalized personality? And then by that extension, like, how would that be any different than, say, humans? Like, maybe Craig Dickinson, your personality is determined by your algorithm, which was developed through, you know, your childhood and your adulthood. Like, we're all just, I guess, like reflections of our choices. And do we really have choices at the end of the day? Because we're just acting in the way we know we should based on our own personal algorithms. I don't know. Who am I?
Yeah, that's great.
Like how responsible? No, this is gonna get creepy. How responsible are we for our own behaviors if we're just responding in the way that our environment raises us to respond? This is not a psychology podcast, so maybe we should just move on.
Well, it's a deep movie, and I don't want to touch your questions. I want them just to linger there. I love them.
I don't want to answer your questions.
No, I don't want to answer your questions. We'll get to those.
I still don't know if Joy is sentient or not. Is what I'm saying.
No, and then like, see, I kind of have that.
Is she just there to manipulate Kay? I don't know.
I have that in final thought. So I'm just going to skip. Like world building, we've talked about repeatedly. But I think this just builds brilliantly on the original. I love that you mentioned the fact it goes outside of Los Angeles and you could see the world in general. I mean, the only thing, I guess you could have gone to the colonies, whatever. There's some reference to that. And that would be a thing they could expand if they were going to do. And I know there's supposed to be a follow-up, like I think Amazon Prime series. 2099, I think, is what it's going to be, which maybe we'll get into those kind of things. Because clearly there's these films, brilliant films, ask way more questions than they answer.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
I love movies. I mean, I think everyone loves movies, but I love movies that there's a question that's unanswerable, and it gets you thinking time and time and time again. And this is one of those movies. Who am I?
Who are you, Justin? I'm moving down to final thoughts because first question is Kay human? And my follow-up is Joy human? And I don't need an answer. I'm just like, that's kind of where I walk away from this. Like,
well, but does the movie ask? The movie doesn't ask if they're human. I think the movie asks, do they have a soul? So then you would ask, what is a soul as defined by the movie? Because I think even Robin Wright's character,
she does, yep,
asks that, like, or even says like, oh, you've been getting along just fine without one, without what, a soul, which is such like a deep dig, but also again goes to the world building. Like there's that extreme prejudice against these people and they've just come to accept it. So what's a soul? Who am I?
Do you have any final thoughts other than who are you?
Craig, I love this movie. I love it so much.
Yeah.
It's beautiful and it's haunting and it makes you think. Everything is perfectly cast. The props, the set design, the music, the sounds, it's just so freaking good. And I'm sad that it did so poorly in the box office and we didn't get like a Blade Runner renaissance after this came out. I feel like it was not appreciated. But if you ever go and look at reviews, everyone's like pretty happy about it. I think the couple of critiques I saw in people's reviews were, oh, it's too long, but it's good.
It's long and it's slow, but like in all the best ways. Like I don't feel like there's anything that's wasted or stretched out.
Yeah, no. It's all relevant. quite a bit. Alien. This is in the same universe as Alien. Is that?
Yes. Is that there, well, there's been some supplemental material that has connected Tyrell with. What's Guy Pearce's character in Prometheus and?
Covenant? Yeah, I know who you're.
Weyland.
Weyland. Yeah, Tyrell and Weyland Corp.
Yeah, Weyland Yutani. Yeah, Weyland and Tyrell are connected. So yeah,
and there's also that scene where Wallace is talking to Kay and they're like walking through the gallery of like, it almost looks like failed replicants or like different models of replicants.
Yeah.
In that scene, this isn't confirmed, but there is a body floating there that looks a lot like a Promethean from Prometheus.
Oh,
okay. If anyone in the audience has seen
that
movie.
Because there's a Dave Bautista one in there too. So.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, you can see very clearly that that's the Zapper model.
Oh.
Yeah.
Neat. Did not notice that.
And we did.
Maybe that's the Promethean because Dave Bautista kind of looks like a Promethean.
That's what I wonder because it's, yeah, very similar.
No, now I got to go back and look at it.
And we should also mention at this point the three short films that are, I think, are probably most of the discs. I know there are Movies Anywhere, which is where I watch this. You have.
They're on YouTube as well. You just
are they? Oh, them. Fantastic.
Yeah, they're free on YouTube.
Great. So, yeah, check those Blackout 2022, 2036 Nexus Dawn, and 2048 Nowhere to Run. The latter two are live action and directed by Ridley Scott's son, Luke. Mm-hmm. I like those a lot. I think you said this as well. The anime one, the first one, not your favorite.
Yeah. There are three short films that are like supplemental material to this one. The first one goes over the blackout that is mentioned a couple times in this film and kind of how that blackout started. And because it's anime, to me, it doesn't feel like it's in the same world as this one. The replicants are far more agile and superhuman and, you know, bouncing off walls and doing flips and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which to me, I'm just like, doesn't match the style of the original films as much. But then the next two are, like Craig said, live action. One of them has Jared Leto and is kind of Jared Leto Wallace pitching his replicant idea to, it's like a board of directors or something.
Yeah, like Benedict Wong's in there banned. In that one too.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's right.
Yep.
And then the third one sets up Sapper and why he's kind of in exile. Well, not in exile, but I guess Sapper and why Agent K was kind of sent to go hunt Sapper down.
It's 2048, so we don't know if it's 6 months before or a couple of months prior. It's definitely, though, it sets up this is how K finds him. It's kind of mm-hmm. way that I read that. So yeah, I enjoyed all of them to varying degrees. I enjoyed the shorter live action ones a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty great, actually, that you had, you know, actors from the film. They felt like cutscenes.
Yeah. I almost, like, going into it, I thought, oh, they're not going to put in the money to get Jared Leto or Dave Bautista.
Yeah.
And yeah, they did.
And wouldn't have had to, but they did. You do have the one thing you do have in the animated one, though, is you do have Edward James almost playing Gaff and a voice role for that. So
yeah.
That's kind of cool. And that's, I mean, it's 2022, so it's shortly after the events of the first one. Anything else that we want to talk about before we get out of here?
I'd be amiss if I didn't complain about something here. Like, just to be fair,
do it.
I kind of had this complaint about the first one is the technology to use seems so clunky. The fact that so many things are like voice activated. I felt that way in the first one when Deckard is scanning the images of the room that he took pictures of. And he's like, okay, 3 degrees to the left, 4 degrees down,
mm-hmm.
zoom. 4 degrees to the left. I'm just like, that seems so tedious. Like, give this guy a mouse or a trackpad or something. And we had the same thing with Joy in this one where she has the glasses on and she is like commanding the drone to fire on K, or not on K, I'm sorry, on the like scavengers
with
that
love.
Are attacking K.
Yeah, Love doing it. Yeah.
Oh, I said Joy. I meant Love. Those names are similar.
Wait a minute. Joy and Love. Are we just now getting that?
Yeah. What is with that?
Dang.
Deeper meaning.
Mm-hmm. Neither one spelled the traditional way, but
both three-letter word. Anyway,
wow,
that just seems so tedious for her to like constantly fire again.
Yeah,
it's like just give her a keyboard or something. That to me was frustrating. Like, no one would design technology that way.
Okay.
But everything else is great. Yeah. I don't know why we're ending on that note, but I got to complain about something.
Yeah. But love, joy. That's interesting.
Yeah. Hmm.
So as we close, we are going to close. Let's go ahead and close. We're going to say thank you for listening, and we're so glad we finally got this episode out. If you'd like to connect with us, you can find us on X and Facebook. Email us at readingbetweenreels@gmail.com. Use the SpeakPipe app on our website. If you enjoyed the show, please, please tell a friend and support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast catcher. Our next episode will be a review of The Gray Man, the Netflix film. Send us an email or voicemail about your favorite moments from The Gray Man, and we'll share it on the next episode. One last thing. Our next few reviews after The Gray Man will be decided upon by our amazing listeners, Justin. You can vote for future movie reviews using the polls posted on our X profile page or on our Facebook group. And for round one, we have The Count of Monte Cristo from 2002, which is currently, it's pretty much a boat race at this point. It's probably going to win. But that's unless right. You want to, yeah, come on. The Last Samurai, or my choice, A Few Good Men. So vote for me. But you can also vote by emailing us at readingbetweenreels@gmail.com or by using the SpeakPipe app. Voting has been open for about a week at the time of this recording and closes on Tuesday, 5/7.